Stories of Love.
You were in Iraq. I didn't want to leave Iraq. So I redeployed.
Recovery.
You know, veterans are dying every day because they don't have the proper access to resources.
And reinvention.
On the whole, it's a lot less stressful than conducting logistics in a deployed environment, which is one of our goals getting into this, is finding peace.
This is Veterans Voices from KUNC News. I'm Desmond O'Boyle. There are over 22 million veterans living in the U.S. today, but the number of Americans that say they know someone who has served in the armed forces is shrinking. For the past month, KUNC and our partners at StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative and Harvest Public Media have been telling just a few of those stories. We learned about the struggles and the triumphs of Colorado's veterans. To begin, a love story. In 2007, Army Major Roy Allen Gilbert and his wife, retired Army Captain Alice Gilbert, were both sent to the war in Iraq. Though the newlyweds were in the same country, they were in different units, making keeping in touch difficult. Eventually, they found a way. They sat down with StoryCorps at Colorado State University earlier this year to talk about it, starting from the day they met.
We had a class together.
ROTC.
ROTC, yeah. At Southern Illinois University was where we met.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during, a first-year class or something. And I'd been in the Army for a couple of years already.
And you were the kid that sat in the back that all the girls had a crush on.
We saw each other at Pinchpenny Pub.
Yep. You offered to make me a homemade meal.
And
we watched Top Gun that night.
We watched Top Gun, and the rest was history. We got married in November, right after Thanksgiving. We didn't really spend much time after that for the next 3 years. I got ready to go on active duty.
So I know what that day felt like on my end.
I mean, for me, it was a whirlwind. But I'd love to hear it from your side.
So we watched Seabiscuit that morning because you left in the afternoon. And then we had to leave partway through. Drove on to post and all the families were standing around. And you guys all got into your platoons. And you looked great standing back there. You looked like the Gilbert that I absolutely fell in love with in ROTC. And you guys marched away singing your cadence. We were very proud, but I remember hanging on to your dad and just, I couldn't physically stand up. It was just physical pain. And he put his arm around me underneath my arm and just held me. Cried hysterically for a minute and got back to the house. And we're like, well, let's just watch a movie. You know, we'll order some pizza. And Seabiscuit came on. And we both went scrambling for the TV to turn it off. And I never did turn it back on until we were back home and we watched it together. You remember shaking out your, repacking your bag?
No.
When we got in the car to go to the airport, you hadn't taken any of your bags out of the car. And so your sleeping bag was still packed in your backpack.
Yeah.
And you shook out your sleeping bag when you pulled it out of the car, and glass shards went everywhere.
Yeah, because the building that I was in when that explosion happened just collapsed on us. And the glass got blown in, and yeah, I don't remember that.
It was like glitter.
In October of 2007, you came to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were in two different provinces. You know, you were in Iraq. I didn't want to leave Iraq. So I redeployed. I think I had asked you at that point whether or not I could just stay, if I could ask for a transfer to your brigade and just go to the Babel province the rest of the time you had on deployment. It took all of July and August to convince every level of leadership up to the division commander that I wasn't crazy, that I wanted to go back, and that I had a legitimate reason for wanting to go back. And then one day I got a signed memo from the division commander saying I was allowed to go back.
I came in probably, you know, 8:30 in the morning or so, and the guys that run the radios at night were just like, your husband's here. I'm like, what? Your husband's here. He's looking for you. He's been in here. We ran out of the tent, and there you were, just like in the middle of the road, just standing there. You're like, hi. That was the first thing you said. Hi, God.
And we stayed. We were in different
different tents.
Tents, you know, different shoes for a while. Did we joke about it and call it Lover's Lane or
Lover's
something?
Lane.
Lover's Lane, because there were so many married couples in that brigade that we just, they moved us all into essentially married quarters in Fob Kalsu, Iraq.
That was the first time we got to live together.
I would go anywhere in the world to be with you.
Literally went to war for me.
I love you.
Love you.
Alice Gilbert left the Army in 2011 and now works for a nonprofit. Alan Gilbert serves in the Army Reserves and works as a systems analyst. They have a daughter and live in Fort Collins. For many veterans, returning home from war is a tough transition. Some can find a new sense of purpose in the field, tending to vegetables or livestock. KUNC and Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon profiles one couple who decided to try farming after combat.
Ben and Letitia Ward's farm in Fountain, Colorado, outside Colorado Springs, doesn't look like an army base or anything. But you quickly start to uncover whiffs of military influence. Take this stack of sturdy fiberglass bins next to a greenhouse.
Case in point, these are the shipping cases for JDAMs. JDAM is a joint directed smart bomb.
Shipping smart bombs. Ward picks up the decommissioned boxes from military surplus sales. He then outfits them as brooding bins for chickens and is using them to design an aquaponic system to grow veggies and fish at the same time.
It was purged courtesy of the U.S. Army. Thank you, U.S. Army. Now it's a fish tank.
The couple's farm, with hoop houses, small sheds, and livestock pens, is built on a foundation of decommissioned military gear, found materials, and old barns.
And it does give us a huge advantage because we can do things cheaper because he doesn't need to go buy something just to do an aquaponics setup.
The couple grew up in Oregon. They met in high school. And because both had family members who'd joined the military, decided to enlist as well. Out of college, the two were stationed at Fort Carson, within earshot of the couple's farm now. While we're chatting, a faint pitter-patter of gunfire off in the distance interrupts us.
What is that gun? Is that a shooting range? Or?
That's Carson.
Fort Carson.
Oh, you can hear it from here.
Oh, yeah. Depending on the atmospheric conditions. We can hear everything, and having a background in that, we can know that that's a, you know, M4, M16 range.
After deployments as Army logisticians in Iraq and Afghanistan, Ben and Letitia wanted to start a family and leave the base behind. Neither grew up on farms, but found themselves drawn to the calmer pace. Plus, the complex nature of farming allows them to draw on the problem-solving skills instilled in them by their military training.
A farm is really just one big logistical problem where you are balancing all of the different requirements versus outputs.
When Ben was in Iraq, his role was to make sure every time a tank would leave the base that it had all the supplies for its trip. Fuel, food, water, ammo. He was constantly preparing. What will the needs be? What's my contingency plan? He's in that exact same mindset on the farm.
I'm forecasting, you know, water usage, what needs to get harvested first versus last, maintenance on the equipment. There's a lot of similarities in that respect.
You can see it in how the farm runs. They grow leafy greens and root vegetables. They raise chickens, ducks, sheep, quail, and turkeys. That diversity is meant to cushion the farm from unforeseen hardships. Like this year, a grasshopper swarm decimated their salad greens, but they were able to blunt the impact by selling eggs and wool.
And that kind of risk management, I think, is really an offshoot of our military conditioning, is that you always have a backup plan.
While they're no longer on active duty, the two haven't fully left their military life behind. They're still in the Army Reserves, another source of income while their two-year-old farm gains its footing. And that means they're often switching between the Army base and the farm.
It's a lot less stressful. We have our stress, but on the whole, it's a lot less stressful than conducting logistics in a deployed environment. Which is one of our goals getting into this is... finding peace, I guess you could say. I don't know. And it has had an effect. We're generally more relaxed than we used to be.
And that's why Ben says when he's selling at the local farmer's market, he spends a lot of time doling out advice to other veterans, advice on how they could start their own farms.
Coming up on Veterans Voices, what happens after service?
The problem that the state of Colorado has is that they've got sick, debilitated PTSD patients right now who need relief.
KUNC's Anne-Marie Awad investigates how some veterans are using unconventional means to treat post-traumatic stress. A Colorado father talks to his daughter about his military career, and a pair of siblings remember their fallen brother. Welcome back to Veterans Voices, a KUNC News special. I'm Desmond O'Boyle. How does a child understand military service? Thomas Chandler was commissioned by the U.S. Marines in 1991. 25 years later, he now teaches middle school mathematics in Fort Collins and serves in the Marine Corps Reserves. He went to StoryCorps to impart some of the lessons he learned with his 7-year-old daughter, Lila.
What was your branch of service? What was your job or assignment?
I was in the Marine Corps, and I was an artillery officer. And when I was deployed and went to Iraq, I was a watch officer in the 1st Marine Division Fire Support Coordination Center. I don't know if that makes much sense to you, so I think maybe we'll just go on to the next question.
What did your dad and grandpa teach you about the military service?
Well, both my dad and my grandfather were in the Army. And what I think I learned from them was that you just do your job the best way you can. My dad was in Vietnam, and he never really told stories of what he did either. And you just do the best job you can.
Is there anything you never told me, but you want to tell me now?
So I want to ask you a question, and maybe this will help me to know how to tell you this. What do Marines do?
They help keep this world safe and do things to protect us.
But do you know what it means, what you might have to do to keep the world safe? What do you think you might have to do?
Work a lot.
Work a lot. Marines fight to keep the world safe. And I hoped that I would have an opportunity to talk to you about what that means. What did you learn about karate, about fighting?
Only do it when you really need to.
Yeah.
To protect yourself and other people. And when you're tired, don't give up. Just continue fighting.
Marines fight, and Marines are ready to fight. The job of a Marine division is to take lives. And it's not ever something that you should be proud of doing. The thing is that we have to be ready to fight, because by being ready to fight, sometimes we can avoid a fight. Like, remember when your karate instructors were talking to you about what you should do if somebody bullies you? What should you do?
You should stop, walk away, and then if they follow you, tell somebody. And if somebody else is getting bullied and it's not you, don't just stand there. Come and help them.
And when you come and help somebody, how should you act?
Nice.
You should act nice and polite. Sometimes having the confidence and being ready to fight can prevent a fight in the first place. Your instructors didn't tell you to fight, but they said it was important to show a lot of confidence, right? Mm-hmm. And respect, because when you show respect for someone else, that shows confidence in who you are. So that's a lot about what Marines do. They're ready to fight, and they do fight. But the best thing that Marines do is when they don't fight. There's probably a lot more for you to learn, but at 7, maybe this is just enough to get you started. Something for you to think about and some questions you can ask me when you're ready. So is this the point where we get to thank each other?
I want to say thank you for the time I got to spend with you and the things I got to learn about the military service and about your life.
Well, I really want to thank you for asking me questions. And most importantly, Lila, this has been a wonderful opportunity for me to share some things that I haven't had a chance to share with you before. And I really hope that maybe when you think about what we've said here today, you'll have some questions, and we'll continue this process of asking questions and answering questions.
Thomas and Lila Chandler live in Fort Collins. Lila is in second grade. The trauma of war doesn't always end when service does. Many veterans are haunted by post-traumatic stress disorder, flashbacks to horrifying events, nightmares, and other issues. One possible treatment, marijuana. 18 states allow that, but not Colorado, despite laws that make it legal. That leaves veterans who use marijuana to treat their symptoms at odds with the state's medical establishment, as KUNC's Anne Marie Awad explains.
Zoloft, Paxil, Wellbutrin, lithium, Ambien, all drugs that are commonly used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. 31-year-old Curtis Bean would rather smoke marijuana. In his Denver apartment, lined with his large, abstract paintings, he takes a long hit from the large, crinkly bag of his vaporizer. Bean's blonde hair is shaved on both sides of his head and kind of long on the top, like a mohawk. He has full sleeves of colorful tattoos on both arms. His big dog quietly trots over and sits next to his feet. He's a 5-year Army veteran who served 2 tours in Iraq. The second time around, he led a team of snipers.
I was programmed to kill, and I was programmed to fight in war. You know, when you get out of the military and you're a civilian, you try to be an adult in society. You know, it's hard.
Before Bean came home from his second deployment, he knew that he had PTSD, something that the Veterans Administration would later diagnose. Over the next few years, Bean would be put on a few different medications to treat his anxiety and depression. And then he found marijuana.
I had a Marine neighbor who introduced me to it. And I, you know, started trying it. I was like, wow, I feel great. You know, and I started doing it more and more and more. Sometimes mostly I just do it at night to help me sleep. Sometimes I would do it, you know, when I'm having, you know, a stressful day, I need to relax.
Bean doesn't have a medical marijuana card, though. When Colorado legalized medical marijuana in 2000, it did so for a list of 8 medical conditions. PTSD was not one of them. For the last several years, Colorado's Board of Health has denied petitions to add it, citing a lack of research trials that prove its effectiveness. Bean can still get marijuana from a recreational dispensary, but it costs twice as much. And he can't discuss marijuana as a treatment option with his VA doctor.
I have long felt that it was completely irrational that we did not allow the veterans' doctors, who know their patients the best, to be able to consult with them about medical marijuana, whether it's right for them, the pros and cons.
This is Oregon Congressman Earl Blumenauer. Earlier this year, he proposed an amendment to a defense spending bill that would have allowed VA doctors to do just that. But at the last minute, the language was removed from the bill.
We're going to get it eventually, but it's just sad that we had backroom maneuvering that overturned votes in both the House and the Senate, and for something that is so important.
Blumenauer hopes that someday medical marijuana will be an alternative to prescription medications like opioids, which the VA prescribes at very high rates, nearly 300% more since 9/11. That's according to the Center for Investigative Reporting. And according to VA researchers, veterans die from prescription drug overdoses at nearly double the rate of the general population. That's why Dr. Sue Sisley says it's a mistake for Colorado health officials to hold out for more testing.
The problem that the state of Colorado has is that they've got sick, debilitated PTSD patients right now who need relief.
Sisley is one of the doctors participating in the nation's first FDA-approved study exploring the use of marijuana to treat PTSD symptoms. The $2 million study is bankrolled by the state of Colorado. Dr. Larry Wolk is the head of the State Department of Health and Colorado's chief medical officer. He says the push for further research is because of how different marijuana is from conventional drugs.
You know, when you think of medicine, you know, we have all these different forms and we have the set sort of levels of potency. But with marijuana, it's just too big a term that encompasses too many different forms and doses that we have to get a little bit more scientific if we want to really classify it as medicine.
Sisley's study is going to try to answer those questions. She and her colleagues hope to enroll participants later this year. But she says the stakes are simply too high for Colorado officials to wait that long to reconsider PTSD for the state's medical marijuana program.
Even if we started enrolling patients tomorrow, we wouldn't have published data for 3 years. And then during those 3 years, how many more people are going to kill themselves and suffer needlessly? I think that the existing body of literature on PTSD is already very compelling.
And so does a state legislative panel that voted unanimously in September to add PTSD. And while the vote isn't binding, it is a recommendation to the full legislature to take up the issue when it's in session in January.
Yeah, definitely people have a studio for their screen printing. I do not. I have my backyard.
Since leaving the Army, Curtis Bean has tried becoming a police officer and a firefighter. Both times, his PTSD was an obstacle. Now he's back in school for painting. His work table is cluttered with several jars of ink and a large, heavy cast aluminum sculpture that he made. It's a face with a pained expression. On either side are two separate pieces, two hands reaching out. Bean is one of a handful of veterans suing the state of Colorado to overturn last year's Board of Health decision.
It's just frustrating, you know, because, you know, veterans are dying every day because they don't have the proper access to resources. You know, this is one huge resource, you know, that they're being denied, which is, you know, for no reason, really.
A judge ruled in May that the Board of Health acted appropriately. Bean and others are appealing that decision.
Sometimes the voices we most want to hear are those we can't, the voices of fallen soldiers. U.S. Marine Sergeant Nick Walsh died fighting in Iraq. He left his wife, two sons, parents, and three siblings behind. His younger brother, Ian Walsh, remembers the day the bad news came. It was the same day he graduated high school. Now Ian is 27, the same age his brother was when he died. He joins his younger sister, Fiona Walsh, in this remembrance.
He had really beautiful blue eyes, and he always had short, even before he joined the Marines, he had short, cropped black hair. He got in trouble a lot. He and my mom and dad fought, I remember that. But then he got out of high school, and he joined the Marines, and he loved it. He was really good at what he did. He was in Force Recon. He became a sergeant.
I just remember him being, like, really big, like, really tall. And handsome and funny.
He was so excited when you were born. You were like his
favorite.
Who
could blame him?
We come from a long line of military family. Our uncle served in Vietnam. Our granddad, our dad's dad, he was in World War II. So my dad, I think, was really proud. But mom was like really, she was really upset. Mom always tells the story about how she remembers, like, his first morning back. She woke up really early, but she found him. He was already awake, and he was ironing his shirts. And it was, like, a totally different Nick, because he used to not do that. But, you know, like, his bed was perfectly made, and he was ironing his shirts. He and his wife and sons came to see us after his first tour. and they spent like a week with us, and it was his first time ever coming to Colorado, and he really loved it here and thought it was so beautiful. And then I can remember watching them leave, and he was waving, and I knew that that was the last time I was ever going to see him. He went on his second tour like a couple weeks later, and then that's when he died. On the highways outside of Fallujah, he was shot by an enemy sniper and he was killed. He was a lot more put together than I was. I don't know. When he died, my life kind of like took sort of a tailspin a little bit. I don't know if it was because he died when I was like graduating or... But I've always kind of been afraid of growing up. I don't know. I've been like afraid of responsibility. He was my age when he died.
How does it feel to like be the oldest now when you weren't? Like, you know what I mean? Like, you were the second oldest.
And now I'm the oldest. I think about that a lot, especially this year, you know? He did so much, and he helped people, and, you know, I don't know. It's hard. It's really hard to lose a sibling. It's really hard. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Much? I mean, yeah. You were, how old were you?
Six.
Six? He loved you.
Well, if you got like one more day with Nick, like if he came back and you could spend one day with him, what would you do?
I would want it to be the whole family. If it's like one day, like you didn't get to spend enough time with him. I don't know. I just would want to hang out. Like I would just like want to ask him a bunch of questions. I'd really like him to be my girlfriend right now, because I really like her, and I his approval would mean a lot to me. I think he would like her too. Just kind of joke around, maybe go see a movie, see something funny, and I don't know, just hang out. Like that's all I'd want to do.
Ian Walsh lives in Fort Collins. He spoke with his younger sister, Fiona Walsh, in a conversation recorded by StoryCorps. I'm Desmond O'Boyle. You've been listening to Veterans Voices from KUNC News. Reports from Luke Runyon and Anne-Marie Awad. Audio from StoryCorps Military Voices Initiative, produced by Ryan Thompson for KUNC. Ryan produced and mixed this special. Brian Larson edited the features. Michael DiJuana was the series editor. There's more on our website, including a conversation between KUNC's Michael DiJuana and NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. They talk about the thousands of soldiers with traumatic brain injuries and mental health disorders kicked out of the Army for misconduct, and a law meant to help wounded troops that misbehave get the care they need. Find that at KUNC.org. KUNC is supported by our members. Thank you.